Welcome to the Base Medrash, the insurance measures program, the summer lecture series for a while. This week's share on two infamous medieval debates and the aftermath of destruction. Rabbi also has some more shirim to give. Please look at the schedule. As everybody knows, we have a summer kollel where we have the kollel people learning with our community. Please speak to me, Jackie Tannenbaum or Danny Sachs, as far as if you're looking to learn with a kollel person at night, an hour a week or an hour a few weeks. And then starting in the beginning of September, we'll have a kollel from YU, led by Rabbi Wiedenblank as Rosh Kollel, specifically geared to learn with our Baal Batim during the weekend, during the evenings. Please also look at the schedule. Eli Rebbe will be starting giving his shiurim next week, as well as being on Shabbos giving the minchas chinuch shiur. And again, I want to thank Rebbe Wall for giving his time and serving our community with that Batis Torah and the Kavod Gadol.
Henry, thank you very much. This evening, what we're going to talk about is a different component of the challenges that we face during the three weeks. We're not speaking tonight about the destruction of the macro, the destruction of individuals, or the destruction of communities. This evening we're going to speak about the war against our theology, the attack against Yiddishkeit, Judaism. There are two famous, I should say infamous, medieval debates, disputations. One of them, the first that we'll speak about, probably the more common to most here, tried to essentially take the system of Torah Shebaal Peh and use it as a proof to the truth of Christianity, to the veracity that the carpenter of Nazareth is a true Messiah. The second did just the opposite. It took the Torah Shebaal Peh and didn't pervert it or corrupt it in that direction, but it defined it as a heresy against the carpenter of Nazareth, against the theology of Augustine Christianity, against the theology of Justin Martyr. And because of that, ultimately the attack against the Torah Shebaal Peh, specifically the Talmud, brought down and brought the end, eventually, of French Jewry. But let's first take a step back and deal with what happened in the land of Sfarad. For our purposes, the watershed year that we should be interested in is 1248. What's 1248? After nine crusades, five of them were more significant than others, what did Christianity have to show for itself? Other than rivers and rivers of blood, Christian blood, Muslim blood, Jewish blood, what did Christianity have to show for itself? It wasn't able to control, quote-unquote, the Holy Land. Palestine, even though it was conquered from the infidel Muslims, was lost. We know what Salah ad-Din did to the Christians. They were left with a couple little bunkers, I would call the Crusader fortresses. One of them was in the Jordan Valley, in Bikat Yarden, and that eventually fell. The Crusader fortress in Akko. But basically, it became Muslim once again. So what did Christianity have to show for itself? One success. One victory. You know what that was? Spain. Go back, those who saw Robin Hood with Kevin Costner and Morgan Freeman. You know, great historical work that it was.
Yeah.
Morgan Freeman in that movie was a Moorish Muslim. The Moorish Muslims, they crossed the Iberian Peninsula into Spain. And they essentially conquered most of Spain. Not only was southern Spain Andalusia was that Muslim, but the center of Spain, the majority of Spain was Muslim. The north was always Christian. What we call Aragon, you know, where Barcelona is, where Girona is, that was Christian. But the center and south of the country was what? Was Muslim. Well, the only success of the crusade was not that they conquered southern Spain, but that they conquered central Spain. Most of Spain, once again, became Christian. That's why we refer to it as what? The Christian reconquest of Spain. When does Spain actually all become Christian? Under Isabel and Ferdinand, in the second half of the 15th century. So what happens? That is a watershed year for us, the Jewish people, 1248. Why? Because it only gets worse. As bad as we had it under the Muslims, and keep in mind the phrase, the golden era or the golden age of Spain, there's no such thing. It was a fabrication created by two groups. First, the German Jews. In the time of the emancipation, they said, look, they wanted to show a historical precedent of when the Jews had equal rights and they contributed to society. So they created this term, the Golden Age of Spain. The other group that used that term were the Eastern European Zionists. Why? Because everyone asked, what are you going to do with the Muslims when you come back to the Holy Land? When you come back to Judea, to Palestine, what we call today Israel? What are you going to do? They're going to just embrace us and say, oh, welcome. Welcome, Jews. You know, it's no longer Ottoman now. We want it to be a Jewish homeland. So he said, no, no, no. It's not like Christian relations. Don't think of your perspective of Russia or Poland or Central Europe. There was always a glorious relationship between Islam and Judaism, between the Muslims and the Jews. It was the golden age of Spain. You and I know that's baloney. And you see how well it's worked in modern times in our Holy Land, in the land of Israel. Think about what happened in Spain. Was it better than Christian Europe and Ashkenaz? Absolutely, 100%. But look, the Almohads, the ones who threw out the Jews, they expelled the Jews from Spain. They said, you have two choices. You convert to Judaism or you're out. Right? The Rambam, how did the Rambam, whose family lived for generations, they were Dayanim in southern Spain, in Cordoba. They ended up going to North Africa. And it wasn't just the Almohads. There are many groups of what we call radical Islamic groups that controlled parts of southern Spain that made it very difficult for Jews. You know, everybody will tell you, Shmuel HaNagid, the great vizier, Shmuel HaNagid, he ran the government, right? He ran the government for the Muslim leadership. That's true. But what they don't tell you is what happened to his son, Yosef HaNagid. You know what happened to him? They executed him. Because when things didn't go well and the people were upset with the government, who did they put the finger to? Who did they make as the scapegoat? The Jew. And they killed him. So it wasn't so pleasant under Islamic Spain. But with that being said and done, Islamic Spain was a wonderful, wonderful gullus relative to Christian Spain. It trumps Christian Spain hands down. Let's talk about what happens in the 1260s. Now, keep in mind one thing. This is true in France. This is true in Spain. It's true in Germany. It's true in Italy. It's true in most European countries. The way we think of a country today, you know, nationalism, that didn't exist then. There's no such thing as Germany or Spain or France. There were small, you know, little fiefdoms. Spain was broken up into little fiefdoms, okay? Sorry?
City-states.
What happens? In the north, the one who was the governmental leader, his name was King James of Aragon. And he actually was a great admirer of the Ramban. The Ramban, as you know, wasn't just a great Talmudist, he was a great doctor. He was a great thinker. He was really a person who was revered, respected by Jew and Gentile alike. There's a problem, though. The government was under the very, very severe influence and control of the church. Now, there are two groups. The Dominican friars and the Frederican friars. One's not a whole lot better than the other. And they were rabidly religious, rabidly anti-Jewish, right? Every Jew is guilty of deicide. And they put a lot of pressure on the government. They really controlled the government. So there was a Jew, unfortunately, and we're going to see this again when we talk about France, a Jew who went Shmad. We don't know what his Hebrew name was. We refer to him as two things, Pablo Christiani or Friar Paul. How did he go from being a Yiddel to Friar Paul to Pablo Christiani? Well, it was a big deal for them at that time to have a Jew, you know, who revoked the heretical theology of Judaism and now saw the true faith of Christianity. They were excited about this. This guy, Pablo Christiani, he was a used car salesman because he told them, I will prove, you'll see, from Jewish sources, you haven't been able to prove from the book of Isaiah because the Jews say it's ahistorical and you're twisting it and perverting it. But I will prove to you from the Jewish work, the Talmud itself, the Jewish work, I'll prove to you that Jesus of Nazareth is the true Messiah. He's the Mashiach. The Midrashim will prove it. All the Torah Shebaal Peh. See, the Bible to you is an open book. It was translated into Latin, right? First it was translated into Septuagint, then into the Vulgate, right? So that you have access to. The closed book, the Talmud, the closed Jewish book, I'll open up its profundities, I'll open up its secrets, and will embarrass the Jews and will show that the Nazarene is a true Messiah. So what was he going to do? He was going to pervert Midrashim and the Gemara to show that it's really a proof. And the Jews are going to be forced to hear this. Now this guy must have thought quite a lot of himself. He must not have been a very significant scholar, because anybody who's learned a little Gemara, learned a little bit of Medrash, knows that's not what you're going to find in the Talmud and the Medrash. But Christians didn't know better. The Dominican friars didn't know better. So they force a debate. What does it mean they force a debate? They take the King James of Aragon, they take his arm, they twist it, and they say, you're going to make the doctor, you're going to make that rabbi, you're going to make him debate. Now, why did they choose Moshe ben Nachman? He was the leader of Spanish Jewry. He was hands down the one who's respected and revered. And by the way, after he leaves, it's his students, the Rashba and the Ra'ah, the two great students of the Ramban, that become the leaders of Spanish Jewry. And after their time, it's their students, the Ritva, the Ran, that become the leaders of Spanish Jewry. Anyways, what happens? Ramban says no. This is a lose-lose. If I lose the debate, it's terrible for the spirit and of the Jews. If I win the debate, it'll be worse, because the nekama, the vengeance that the Dominican friars will take, the vengeance that will be, you know, perpetrated against the Jews will be far worse than if I lost. He had no choice. King James of Aragon had no choice. They forced this debate. Nebuch. What happens? We have it. It's translated into English. Rabbi Chevelle translated it. You know, Rabbi Chevelle is known for many things, right? The Grossinger Rebbe, you know, was a Rabbi Machsher. Those of you who used to go to Far Rockaway, you know, before there was central air conditioning. But he's known eternally for the great work that he did on the works of the Ramban. What he did with Rabbeinu Bachai, these works. What happens? The Vikuach, the disputation. After a number of sessions, the Dominican friars stop it. Because the Ramban wipes the floor with Pablo Cristiani. The Dominican friars say, this is backfiring. This is terrible. If anything, it's disproving the theology of the Gospels. Ramban does something after these series of forced debates. It's Shavuos. And the Jews come together, right? We're not working on Shavuos. And he reviews with them the issues that were discussed in the debates. Like you and I would say, a chazar shir. It's a review of all the principles. What is our notion of the Messiah? What is the role of the Messiah? How are you supposed to understand Yeshaya? What does this Midrash mean when it says that the Mashiach was born on Tisha B'Av? Sounds like he was born already. No, it's an idea. Like most Midrashim, it's not meant to be taken literally. It means what? Out of the destruction and devastation, that leads to the Jewish people doing a tshuva, engaging in a cathartic transformation. And out of that cathartic transformation emerges out of that what? A different people, a different Jewish people, and ultimately the beginning of the Messianic era. You know, etc., etc. Many of the issues that were discussed. Well, the Ramban had asked for one thing. When he was forced to do this debate, he said on one condition, freedom of speech. You've got to allow me freedom of speech. And they did, which is why he wiped the floor with Pablo Cristiani. But he didn't get freedom of speech to do a review session with the Jews when? To do a review session over Shavuos. The Christians would never ever again make this mistake. This will be the first and the last time that a Jew is given freedom of speech in a theological disputation. So what happens? They want to drive the Ramban out of the country. they're furious that he didn't have a right to blaspheme the Gospels, to blaspheme the Nazarene, to blaspheme, you know, the theology of Justin Martyr and St. Augustine. What happens? Ramban is an elderly man. We're talking now in the 1260s. He's not a young man. See, today, if you're 70, you're a puppy. Today, if you're 70, you kidding? We just allow you to drive and get the ability to drink. It's a different world today. When you were 70 in medieval times, they called it a zaken. What happens? Ramban is a zaken, now has to leave this country, leave his flock, leave his people, and he goes to Israel. He goes to Palestine. You know what it was like to travel on the Mediterranean in the 1260s? It's not like today. You know, you hop on an El Al flight or Iberia Airlines and, you know, you're there in a couple hours. It didn't work that way then. King James of Aragon, when he approaches the Ramban, he comes to him with a huge amount of gold. Remember, you know, today, you know, we have electronic wire transfers. They didn't have wire transfers in the 1260s. Ramban wouldn't take money. He says, your people are going to need this. Please take this. Your people will need this in the future. And how right was King James of Aragon? He knew. He knew what these Dominican friars were. And in future debates, in Tortosa and other times, it was shreklich. It was terrible for the Jews. Because imagine, you know, going into the ring against Muhammad Ali or Joe Frazier with two arms tied behind your back. You're not going to make it past the first 30 seconds. And that was what future debates were after this. They learned their lesson from this disputation. So the aftermath is Ramban goes to Israel. He describes, he sends documents back. There's a Jewish community in Shechem. And in Shechem, they're housing the Sifrei Torah from Yerushalayim. Because when the Crusades took place, the Jews evacuated the Sifrei Torah. They shouldn't be destroyed. And there's a community in Hebron. Think about it. Today, you know, the disputed areas, Hebron, Shechem, those were the two strong Jewish communities. He writes the following. He says that the place that is the most holiest place on earth is the most charev. It's the most desolate, destroyed. It's the place which is the most a mess. He comes to Yerushalayim and he's awestruck by the devastation there. And what does he do? He wasn't a poor man, the Ramban. He brings Jews from Hebron there and he supports them. He reestablishes a minyan in Yerushalayim. Why? How can you not have a Jewish presence in Yerushalayim? The reestablished Jewish presence in Yerushalayim that he does in the early 1270s, that is the beginning of the community that ultimately becomes the majority community of Yerushalayim. We have Ottoman records, we have British records. There may not have been a majority of Jews in all of Palestine, but there were a majority of the population in Yerushalayim was Jewish. Who's responsible for that? The Ramban. And that minyan that he establishes goes until 1948, when our cousins, quote-unquote, the friendly, peace-loving Arabs, the Jordanians, you know what happened in 1948? They drove every Jew out of Yerushalayim, out of the Yer Atika. They took over our place, our Makomos HaKadoshim, and you know what they did with them? They took the matzevos from the base of Kvaros and made them into toilet seats, paved roads with them. So in 1967, after the hand of Hashgacha, after the miracle of what we call the Six-Day War, when the Harel Brigade comes into Yerushalayim, and we reconquer the city, they weren't even sure exactly where was the famous minyan of the Ramban. So there's a speculation. And that spot, the Jews come in, and they reestablish the famous minyan. And when they reestablish it, they make one condition. One condition is this. This is the place, this is the city of the Jewish people. This is the makom of tefillah for the Jewish people. It's not going to be Ashkenaz, it's not going to be the Eidot HaMizrach, it's not going to be Sfarad. Whoever gets the Amud, it's the place for Klal Yisrael. Whoever gets the Amud, if you're an Ashkenazi, it'll be Ashkenaz. If you're a Sfaradi, it'll be Sfaradi. If you're a Nusach Sfarad, it'll be Nusach Sfarad. How did they know where it was? Because the churba they had, they knew it's in relationship to the churba. They knew how far it was from the churba. That's why they picked that spot. And we believe that's the spot where it was. So today, many of you have gone to the shul, the Ramban. It was reestablished. There's like about 3 or 4 different minyan rooms there. And that's the one principle. The one principle is, whoever gets the amud, that's the nusach it is. There's a famous igeris. We call it the igeris haramban. Right, that he sent to his son, that his son should say it. Was it once a week, I believe? Once a month? I forgot if it was once a month or once a week. That actually is not the igeris of the... We call it the igeris of the Ramban. It predates the Ramban. The Ramban saw that, and he felt that it was very meaningful and very profound. And he sent it to his son. He recommended him saying it. But he actually is not the author of that. What he is the author of course, besides the records of the disputation, which he records. This is 2 famous commentaries on the Gemara, on the Talmud. His famous commentary on the Chumash, which is the basis of all Jewish philosophy. But after the event of the disputation in the 1260s of the Ramban in Barcelona, it only gets worse. And what was that attack? It was a way of Christianity co-opting, perverting, trying to destroy the Torah Shebaal Peh, not by destroying it, but by perverting and bastardizing the Torah Shebaal Peh to be, so to speak, a source or proof to the Gospels, to the theology of Christianity. The other disputation was even more horrific. And again, like the disputation in Spain, in Barcelona, this disputation in Paris could never have taken place had it not been for 2 crucial factors. Rabid, sick, religious Christians, the Dominican friars, and in this case, I just want to make a parenthetic remark. You know, I have nothing against any of you, anyone who is from St. Louis. It's a very fine town, McDonnell Douglas. They do a lot of good work in terms of aircraft. Nothing against the Cardinals, right? Tony La Russa, maybe the greatest manager we've had in the last quarter century. But I vomit every time I want to say the word St. Louis. Why? Because St. Louis is referring to King Louis IX of France. Yamach Shemo v'zichro. This religious fanatic, who was under the influence of Pope Gregory IX, made great sorrows for the Jewish people. So you had the Dominican friars in King Louis IX, the man that they referred to as St. Louis. And who else did you have? A Gishmada Yid, a Jewish apostate, Nicholas Donen. And what happened in 1240? Nicholas Donen took a different approach. He was much more capable, much more intellectually solid than Pablo Cristiani. And he said just the opposite. Nicholas Donen, who became an apostate, became a Christian, an apostate to his faith, he said that the Talmud is against the theology of Christianity. It is vile. It is a heinous document. It says heresy against the Nazarene. It says heresy against the Virgin Mary. And it's a work that must be destroyed. It must be put on trial and destroyed. And I got to tell you something. He was much more accurate than Pablo Cristiani. What happened? There's a famous forced disputation where they took the great leader of French Jewry, Rabbeinu Yechiel of Paris, he is forced, along with others, to defend the Talmud against the attacks of Nicholas Donen, the apostate Jew. Now the problem with this is, who is the judge, who is the jury, and who is the prosecutor? All one and the same. It's Nicholas Donen and the Dominican friars. They're the prosecutors, the judge, and the jury. So it was a fait accompli before any disputation took place. Unlike what happened in Barcelona in 1263. step back. This attack against the Talmud, when we say the Talmud, we mean the Torah Shebaal Peh, and we're going to come back to it. We have to look at it in a context. And the context is the following. There were a lot of attacks against works that were perceived as heretical to Christianity. I'll give you an example. In 1209, and I apologize, I forgot which university it was, but they took all the works, they put Aristotle on trial, and then they eventually burnt the works of Aristotle. In 1232, not in Paris, but in Montpellier, in Provence, in Montpellier, the famous works of the Rambam, right? They claimed that Sefer Mada, which we have Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah that defines the philosophy of Judaism, and the Mor Nevuchim, the famous Guide to the Perplexed, were heretical works. And I want to tell you one thing. The tragedy of the burning of the works of the Rambam in 1232 in Montpellier, that was the catalyst for that. That was exacerbated by Jews, because Provence was really the battleground as to whether you were pro the Rambam's rationalistic philosophy, a neo-Aristotelian, neo-Platonic philosophy of how Judaism related to neo-Aristotelian thought, or whether you were anti the Rambam. That's where the great debates were. The Chochmei Lunel, the great scholars of Provence, were some of the Rambam's greatest supporters, and it was Provençal Jews who were some of the Rambam's greatest attackers. In Nebuch, they go to the Christians. What do you think happens once you get the Dominican friars involved? What do you think is going to happen? I can tell you, no good. So what happened? When you go to Paris, there's a place known as Le Place de Concours. We say in English, the Concord Plaza, right? Le Place de Concours. Okay? And it was at that spot that 2 years after the debate, the famous 24 cartloads of the Talmud, which were gathered from throughout France, throughout Provence, because remember, there was no country France, there were different areas. Documents, Talmudic copies, from England, from throughout Ashkenaz, were gathered there and burnt. There in the Place de Concours outside the Louvre. Now, why is this terrible? Contrast this for a second to what happened in Rome in 1545. I apologize, my Italian's not that great, but the Plaza of the Flowers, I forgot, Piazza di Fur or something, I'm not sure how that is pronounced. But they burnt the Talmud, that the text of the Talmud in 1545. But you know what the difference was? In 1545, what had been invented?
The printing press.
Italian Jewry was not destroyed because they burnt the Talmud. It was a great tragedy, but we were able to rebound. In 1242, what happens? Do you understand? Think about it if you and I were scribes. Let's say you and I were a sofer. We were good. We have good calligraphy. How long would it take us to write one page of the Gemara, not two sides, one side, a daf, with the Rashi commentary? Think of how long that would take. You know, with a quill, in the fountain, you know, the fountain of ink. Do you understand, with the destruction of the Talmud, which preceded by 10 years earlier the destruction of the Rambam, that's it. Jews can't live in France. We're not expelled from France till the early 14th century. There are different expulsions when we come back. But the death of French Jewry is not in the early 14th century. It's in 1242. Because we can't raise children there because we don't have a text to teach them with. Do you ever wonder why it is that there are so many Sephardic Jews with the last name Tsarfati? You know what Tsarfat means? Tsarfat means French. A Frenchman. Tsarfati means a Frenchie. How come if you're a Sephardi, they call you Frenchie? because you were a Jew who, after the burning of the Talmud in 1242, where were you going to go? One of the places you'd go is you'd cross the Pyrenees into France. I'm sorry, into Spain. It was terrible. And you have to understand, it was acts like this that got Louis the Ninth sainted to become St. Louis. It was vicious. Rabid, passionate Christian fervor. One of the ramifications of this was, after this event, the disputation in 1240, the burning of the Talmud in 1242, do you know what we did? We the Jews? From that point on, we self-censored. Let me just give you an example. Do you know there's only one extant manuscript of the Talmud that survived the burning of the Talmud in 1242? It's called the Munich edition. If you look at a work called Dictuque Sophrim, sometimes I'll quote the München manuscript. That's all it survived. We took out all the Christological references. Let me give you a couple of examples. The Gemaras in Sota and Sanhedrin that describe, you know, Miriam, who they call Mary, who was not the most chaste woman on the face of the earth. Needless to say, she gave, you know, the Roman soldiers had business with her. The story of Yeshua Notzri as a student of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. By the way, based on that Gemara, many Protestant theologians believe that Jesus is a composite character. That person didn't exist, but he's a composite character of many different charismatic leaders. And if you look at the Christological references in the Talmud that we've self-censored, only today do we have them. Why? Because after Vatican II in the 1960s, we went back into the Vatican and we were able to take out the manuscript from Chulin, in Sanhedrin, in Sota, and in Brachos, and now do we have them once again? Only because they were in the Vatican. I mean, let me give you one example. There's a Gemara in Brachos, Daf Yud Aleph. I think it's Yud Aleph on the base, but Daf Yud Aleph. What does it say? It says that in our davening, we used to say, in the middle of davening, in the section of the Shema, we used to say the Aseres Hadibros, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. So that in the time of the Amoraim, they wanted to put it back into davening. They said, no, you can't do that. Why? Because in the period of the Amoraim, they were living among Zoroastrians and Parthians. They weren't living amongst Christians in Bavel. So the Gemara says, no. Kvar bitlum. The rabbis have already nullified it. They've already taken it out of the Siddur, out of the davening. And this is what our text of the Gemara has. Mipnei tar omes ha'akum. Because of the provocations of the pagans. What pagans had provocations about the Ten Commandments? So if you look in the Vatican, what does the Gemara say? It doesn't say Mipnei tar omes ha'akum because of the provocations of the pagans. It says Mipnei tar omes ha'minim. What is the word min? Literally means a heretic. But what is the Mishnaic term min? It's referring to the Judeo-Christians. The heresy of the Apostle Paul, or I should say the apostate Paul. In the heresy that what? That now after Jesus, you don't require deed. Only the Ten Commandments. That's the only thing that came from God, and the rest is man-made, and now that Jesus has come, all you need is creed, is faith. Why did the rabbis take the Aseres Hadibros out of davening? Because the Judeo-Christians, the students of Paul or Shaul of Tarshish, his Hebrew name, the students of Shaul of Tarshish who followed their mentor Shaul, what do? They said, you see, look at that. They put it into the davening because they know, the Jews themselves know, this is the only thing from God, the rest is man-made. And now that Jesus has come, you don't have to do the man-made stuff. I mean, it's a heresy. What happens? Mit kvar bitlum, that was already nullified, mit ne tar omos, not ha'akum ha'minim, because of the provocations of the Judeo-Christians. Look at Rashi there. We don't have a Rashi. If you look in the Vatican, it quotes the Rashi. The manuscripts quote the Rashi. What does it say? What's ha'minim? Tamidei Yeshu ha'notzri. The students of Jesus of Nazareth. This is an example of the Christological references that we self-censored. Because of the rabid anti-Jewish feeling there was amongst the Christians. Now, what's the point? By the way, Aleinu, right? The Christians thought the line, Shehem Shtachavim Lehevel Varik, they prostrate to something which is meaningless and nonsense, Umispalalim El Lo Yoshia, and they pray to a God that will not grant salvation. So Yoshia sounds like Yoshua or Yeshu. They thought it was a knock on Jesus. It wasn't a knock on Jesus. It was a quote from the Yeshaya Navi. That verse is from the prophet Isaiah. But they viewed it. We took it out. We changed the text of the Bracha Achrona of the Haftorah. By the way, in the davening, what is the real text of the 19th Bracha? Vilaminim al tehi tikva. Who are the minim? The Judeo-Christians. The students of the Apostle Paul. And other Judeo-Christians. We changed it to Vila Malshinim. Why? Because of the reverberations that we would get from the Christian world. This is all the aftermath of what happened in 1240 and 1242. The Kina Sha'ali Srufa Ba'esh was written by the Maharam of Rothenburg, the famous Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. German Jewry had been devastated, almost annihilated, in the aftermath of May and June of 1096 of the First Crusade. The only reason Ashkenaz survived was because one of the great students of the yeshivas of Mainz and Worms was brought back to his own hometown. Who is that? Rashi was brought back to Tours, and he brought back a group of students, Rabbeinu Simcha, the Machzor Vitri, his sons-in-law, who became the beginning of the, what we call the Balei Tosfos. That whole Tekufa, the whole Misora transferred from Germany to France, because the French were not killed by Godfrey of Bouillon, whereas the German Jews were obliterated by the People's Crusade and then by Peter the Hermit. Now, the Misora, the basis of our theology, is rooted where? In northern France. 1240 and 1242 destroys all of that. Just to give you an example. The great mayor of Rothenburg, he was only 25 at the time. Why is he not learning in Germany? Because all the scholarship, all the great schools, the primary schools of thought are where? They're in France. So he's studying by Rabbi Yechiel of Paris as a student there. He is an eyewitness. He's an eyewitness to the destruction in La Place de Concours. And he writes this kina. What we address and what we mourn, and by the way, I want to make a comment before I continue. This issue of the 41st Kina, of the disputation in Barcelona, this is a very relevant issue today. Not because of the attack coming from Christianity, but in modern times, the attack on the Torah Shebaal Peh, the attack on our Masorah is coming from where? From Islam. What's the whole idea of Sharia? Sharia is predicated upon the system of halacha. What's the whole idea? Islam is a successor religion to Christianity and Judaism. I mean, just simple examples. This idea of the Hajj. What's the Hajj? It's from the word chag. Or if you pronounce it in that part of the word, the guttural, hug. The chag. So our chag is where? To Yerushalayim. Their chag is to Mecca. The holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, how many times do we daven? Five times. Maariv and Shacharis and Musaf and Mincha and Ni'ilah. They're going to one-up us. They pray every day five times. Right? We only do Hishtachavaya in the Beis HaMikdash or Lifnei Hashem on Yom Kippur. They're going to do Hishtachavaya. They're going to prostrate every day. The Akedah of Yitzchak becomes what? The Akedah of Ishmael, etc., etc., etc. The notion of usurping the true religion, usurping the system of Chachmah, of truth, which is what Christianity did, and because it was rejected by Judaism, it was rejected by the Torah Shebaal Peh, Christianity went to war against the Torah Shebaal Peh. We're having that exact same issues are becoming relevant today, where Islam is not just going to war against Jews. Islam in many of its faces, not all, not everywhere, but in many guises, is going to war against Judaism. And this is the great tragedy of what happened in France in the 1240s. And this was really the death knell of French Jewry. At this time, what do the French do? They end up going back to Germany. They end up, as we mentioned, crossing the Pyrenees, going into Spain. But French Jewry, as we knew it, is over. Remember, the greatest school of Ashkenaz, the Baalei Tosfos, right? It revolutionized the whole Jewish intellectual world. You know, the Ramban brings the Chochmah of the Baalei Tosfos to Spain. And it's the Ramban and his students, the Rashba, the Ra'a, and their students, the Ritva. That whole notion of how to look at our corpus of the Masorah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, as one organic unit that the Baalei Tosfos taught us, eventually, where does that live? Where does it continue? Not in France, because there's no Jews left in France. There are no academies left in France, because there's no text to study. You know where it continues in the end? In Spain and in Germany. The Maharam of Rotenburg, his student Rabbeinu Asher, his other student, the Mordechai, that's where it carries on. We are a little bit behind in time, so we're only going to spend a few minutes in the text itself. But it's a very rich, beautiful text. It's a very sad text. Take a look, if you don't mind, towards the end of the Kinnah. The page 593 and 592. By the way, those listening at home, in the OU, the Rabbi Soloveitchik Kinnos, Psalm 41, Sha'ali Srufa Ba'esh, starts on page 590, goes through page 593. I'm going to borrow a few lines. On page 593, the fourth line. Bani kishakul, I, meaning the Jewish people, with the loss of our Torah, the loss of our Masorah, and bereft. It's like a mother who's lost her children. V'galmud nisharti levad, remain alone. Kitoren barosh har migdalayich, like a mast or a flag on the head of on the mountain. Do you ever see the, very often, let's say there's the Rav used to describe, you have a port, or let's say you have a fortress. So when there's a port, you know, there's a busy town, it's a port city. You know, it's a lot of action there. Or fortress, you know, you have a whole, think about like in America, right? These towns, the whole economy is based upon the military fort. What happens when everyone leaves? All that's left is the flag. The flag might still be there, but it's barren, it's bereft of any life, of any vigor. Without the Torah, we might still be in France for a couple more years, but without the Talmud and the commentaries of Rashi, the whole Masorah that comes from the yeshivas of Mainz and Worms that Rashi put into his kuntres, it's all gone. Look at what a Jew is without our educational books, without our Gemaras. It takes two generations, and we're gone. We're intermarried, we're assimilated. And of course, this group didn't intermarry and assimilate. This group migrated, whether it was to Germany or whether it was to Spain. That's one powerful line. The third line on page 593, Lakach Tzor Kaspo. The imagery from Shir Hashirim of a husband and wife, right? The God and the Jewish people. If a husband goes out of town, so in order that his wife is taken care of, what does he do? He leaves assets. Tzor Kaspo means he leaves her assets, money, so she can support herself, support the family while he's on the business trip. The Almighty is left. Meaning what? The fact that he allowed his Torah to be destroyed, our whole relationship to God is through the Torah Shebaal Peh primarily. But he's left us with nothing. nothing to support ourselves, which again is why French Jewry dissipates in a very short time. Halach b'derech melemerechok, he's left. V'imo halo nasutz lalayich. The clouds, so to speak, of the protective cloud. What is a protective cloud? It protects you from the heat, the blaze of the sun. But God's protective cloud did not, it's not there. We're not worthy of the divine protection. In the blaze, the fire has devoured what? The 24 cartloads of the Gemara that were destroyed. Lo eshma'od l'kol sharim v'sharots. I don't hear the sound of the singers. Who's that? The Talmidei Chachamim. Articulating the beautiful values and the beautiful principles of the Torah. The sweet music of ideas and substance and meaning. They're not there. Kinitku meisrei tupechalat. They've all been removed. Next paragraph. Zaki b'kol mar letzur. I cry out with a bitter, bitter voice. Ashiv ronech v'alchalyech. V'lu yizkor avas klulusayech. What, there's a quote from Yirmiyahu. What about the days, so to speak, when we were your kala? When you gave us the Torah at Sinai, right? That was the, so to speak, that was the like the ring or the document that, of our marriage, the ketubah. You know, the love that we had. When we frolicked together. When we came to know each other through us studying your Torah. It's all gone. That love is gone. We don't have it. Chigri levush sak. To wear sackcloth, alei avara, over the destruction, the burning, asher yatza lechalek, the sofsas tulayich. It's totally consumed, consumed everything. Yashiv shvus shiftei yishurun. Please, God, bring back what? Bring back the fugitive, the refugees of your people, Yeshurun, of the just, the honest, the upright people, the Jewish people. The Yarimesh Falayich, we're so downtrodden. Not only do they abuse us and mock us, but they mock the very Torah that is our lifeblood. Please enable us to stand up and to arise from this mess. Yarum Levavi, last line, Be'es Tzuri L'Orlach, V'yagia L'choshkech, V'yaira Feilayach. Please God, the darkness that we're in, because when a Jew does not have Chochma, when a Jew doesn't have the Torah Shebaal Peh, when a Jew doesn't have the Talmud to enlighten us, to teach us our values, how to think, how to act, how to weigh issues in the world, then we walk in darkness. Then we're literally in the dark. So please God, take us out of that darkness. Let's just go back, because we only have a few more minutes. Let's just go back to page 590, 591. Third paragraph. Tzuri b'lapid ve'esh ha'avur zeh nisanech. Right? You have the Maharam of Rutenberg says something interesting. The Torah was given in fire, right? The fire at Har Sinai. What do we call it? Esh das lamo. The fiery law, the theology of fire. It was given in fire, and now it's been taken from us in fire. How can that be? Mashal, the second last line of the third paragraph. Mashal l'melech asher bocha l'mishtev v'no. Tzofa asher yigva, kein ad b'milayach. What's the analogy? Comparison to a king who cried at his own son's wedding feast, knowing that his son would die. Is that what you stand for at Sinai? Meaning what? You bring a child into the world. You have a simcha by the bris milah. You have a simcha by the bar mitzvah. You have a simcha by the wedding. Eventually the child is going to die because we were all born to die. We're not going to last forever. But we thought the Torah would be eternal. But is that what happened? That Torah that you had a wedding feast for. What was the chasana? The chasana was Har Sinai, between the Jewish people and the Almighty. A person may not live forever. So at the time of the simcha, you rejoice. But the Torah we thought would last forever. We thought that would be not just a temporary rejoicing, but an eternal rejoicing. And now we see you've taken it away. You've allowed it to be destroyed at the hands of vile, heinous heretics. Ori Demos, the fourth paragraph. Adeyu Kanacha. My tears are not just a few tears. It's like a river, a raging river. What did we know? What's one of the principles of Judaism? Torah is eternal. It's immutable. It's not something that is subject to whims or to change. Which is why we rejected the theology of Christianity that said once the Nazarene comes, now there's a new theology. It's a dirty word for a Jew to say the New Testament. We refer to it as the Gospels. There is no New Testament. There's no abrogation of the covenant. Chas v'shalom. But what? It's as if what? Moshe v'Aaron bar har v'eshal yesh Torah chadasha. What, is there a new Torah now? You've destroyed the old Torah? You've destroyed the Torah that they claim is the Old Testament? It's been burned, it's been annihilated, it's been destroyed? B'chein nisrifu g'lilayich? Next paragraph. Etma l'nafshi. I can't even enjoy the taste of food. Words, when there is no Yiddishkeit, when the whole Mesorah has been destroyed and the Torah has been destroyed, it's a life that's not worth living. There's no geschmack in life. Acharei ra'osi asher asfu shalalayich. El toch rechava ke nidachas v'sarfu shalal elyon. In your nidachas is what? It's a city of paganism, of idolatry. So you take all the assets into the middle of the city and you burn it. But this is the Torah Kedosha. This is the essence of Judaism, the Torah Shebaal Peh. What is this, an Irni Dachas, that you take it into the middle of the city, La Place de Concours, and you burn it all? And you turn it to ashes? Lo Eida Limsal Derech Slula. Achia Yoavelos Nesiv Yosha Mesilayich. I cannot find a clear path. Turn to grief are those straight paths of yours. A Jew without our values, without our Mesorah, without our principles laid out in the Talmud, we're lost. There is no path. And French Jewry was lost. This was the end of French Jewry. So, just to review, what did we discuss tonight? That the experience of Tisha B'Av in the 3 weeks is not just the mourning and the reliving of the destruction and devastation of our people, be it the masses, be it the individuals, be it the scholars. But it's also the mourning over what? The blasphemy, the attack against our theology, the attack against our Mesorah, our tradition, and the attempt to destroy that tradition. That's something that what? The Greeks tried to do, leading up to the Hanukkah revolt. It's something that was attempted by the Romans, during the Hadrianic Decrees in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt. But it's something that wasn't just attempted, but was perpetrated successfully by Pope Gregory the Ninth, by King Louis the Ninth, and by the Dominican friars, with the assistance of the apostate Jew Nicholas Donin, Yamach Shemo v'Zichro. And this is the end of French Jewry. And this is the end of the great Balei HaMesorah. The school that we refer to as the Balei Tosfos that started, that was the savior of our Mesorah in the aftermath of the destruction of German Jewry. This is the end. And the Mesorah now has to move. It's a miracle that it survived. Be it in Spain, with the great Sephardic scholars, the Ramban and that whole school fought. Be it temporarily in Germany, because it didn't last very long in Germany. It only lasted a half century there, before the Rindfleisch massacres killed the Mordechai, and you know what happened to the Maharam of Rotenberg himself. He was incarcerated the rest of his life. His other student, Rabbeinu Asher, had to flee and fled to Spain. But at least for about a half century, it will survive in Germany. And ultimately, from Germany, what happens is the Mesorah moves where? It moves west. I apologize, it moves east, first into Galicia, then into Poland, into Lita, ultimately into Hungary, Czechoslovakia. But that Mesorah that was destroyed through only Chesed Elyon, only through God's God's miraculous intervention. It will survive in the East in Poland, and it will survive in Sfarad in Spain. This is the story of the 41st Kina. And as we started this year, this is also the story of the attack on our Masora in Spain as well. Thank you. Amen. 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 Amen.